in various areas in central and southern Gaza. Meanwhile, another journalist was killed in a drone attack on his home west of the Nusayras refugee camp in central Gaza. The death toll from the Israeli genocide since October 2023 now exceeds 57,700, with over 137,600 others injured. Since the start of the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, 73 Palestinians have died under torture inside Israel's notorious prisons and detention centers. Most of the deaths occurred amid torture, medical negligence, starvation, and systematic violence since far-right Israeli politician Itamar Ben-Gvir took over the regime's so-called security ministry.
Since the launch of the Israeli genocidal war on Gaza back in October 7, 2023, reports of torture, starvation, medical negligence and abuse in the regime's detention facilities have surged dramatically, leading up to at least 73 fatalities inside the prisons. The figure has surpassed even the most notorious prison in the world, Guantanamo Bay facility of the United States.
منذ 7 أكتوبر عام 23 شهدت السجون والمعتقلات.
The 7th of October in 2023 was the turning point in Israeli policies against the Palestinians inside prisons. The deliberate deprivation of medical care and aggressively brutal torture resulted in more than 73 deaths. This number refers only to the disclosed cases, let alone those who have been forcibly disappeared. All this is surely a war crime and goes against international law, especially as it comes out from the Israeli regime that must abide by the Rome Statute.
Despite the growing number of prison deaths, no Israeli officials have been held accountable. The Israeli military typically classifies these cases as under investigation or death from natural causes. Just like Khalil Haniyeh, whose wife came to know 1 year after his abduction that he was beaten to death.
Initially, I didn't know anything about his condition inside the prison. He was abducted from our displacement camp. I used to look for those who were released to ask if they knew anything about him. After almost a year, I was told he had a severe injury in his head and was taken away by jail staff. 4 months later, I was informed that he was released, and then they told us again that he was dead. It was inhumane.
The number of Palestinian detainees has doubled since October 2023, rising from 5,250 to over 10,000. A quarter of whom are being kept at undisclosed locations in severe conditions, especially when far-right politician Ben-Gvir took over the regime's so-called security ministry. Numerous rights groups say Israel's prison system has become a crucible of deliberate cruelty.
The escalating death toll among detainees is now part of a broader pattern of collective punishment of Palestinians, both inside and outside Gaza, which raises serious questions about Israel's compliance to the international law and the accountability of its officials. Nader Brahim, Gaza City.
The military wing of Hamas has released new footage of a recent anti-Israeli operation in Gaza, showing an attempt to capture one of the regime soldiers who was later killed while trying to escape. The Israeli army has confirmed that an Al-Qassam brigade fighter attempted to capture the soldier during last week's attack on its forces. The soldier was identified as Avraham Azoulay, a reservist operating a military bulldozer used in the demolition of Palestinian homes in Gaza. The incident sparked backlash across the occupied territories, with media outlets criticizing Israeli commanders for claiming victory over Gaza resistance. The released footage also documents resistance fighters targeting two Israeli military vehicles and two bulldozers east of the southern Gaza city of Gan Yunis. The operations were part of the resistance broader Stone of David campaign. Hamas has slammed the recent remarks by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in which he ruled out the possibility of a comprehensive truce deal for Gaza. The movement said Netanyahu's remarks reflect his malicious and ill-intended efforts to block any deal that could lead to the release of Israeli captives and an end to the regime's aggression against Gaza. Hamas added that it had previously offered a comprehensive proposal to release all captives at once in exchange for an end to the aggression, for withdrawal of Israeli forces and unrestricted flow of aid. Netanyahu, however, turned down that agreement. Hamas also condemned what it described as Netanyahu's attempt to derail the ceasefire process. The movement, however, affirmed its continued commitment to engage positively and responsibly in negotiations aimed at ending the war. Earlier, we spoke with political analyst William Jones about the outlook for ceasefire efforts in Gaza. Here's what he had to say.
Well, Netanyahu's program, obviously, is that ultimately he wants to have a greater Israel. He does not want a Palestinian state at all. Now, that's something that has never been accepted by the world. It is not something that has ever been accepted by the Israeli people over the last 50 years or so. Nevertheless, Netanyahu feels, to the extent that he still has the backing from the United States or the backing from President Trump in moving forward, that he can step by step move in the direction, first of all, of attaining entire control of Gaza. Now he's talking about limiting the Palestinian population to the south of Gaza, but he really wants the whole area. And if he moves in that direction, of course, is going to be the West Bank as well, which he intends to take under his wing. I don't think that will succeed because world opinion is still very strong, not as loud as one would want. You see that also the American population, which has been something of a sleeping giant in many respects with regard to the genocide in Palestine, they also will start to wake up. And I think at that point, this then becomes a different political reality that President Trump has to deal with.
Israeli forces of Italy shot two young Palestinians in the occupied West Bank after they carried out a retaliatory attack that left at least one Israeli soldier dead. The Palestinian Health Ministry identified the men as Mahmoud Ahmed from Alul and Malik Salim from Bizriya, not east of Nablus. The two men were killed south of Bethlehem, and their bodies were seized by Israeli forces. The regime's military said the men carried out a combined shooting and stabbing attack near the Gosh Etzion settlement, killing one security officer and injuring at least four others, some in critical condition. The spokesman for Hamas military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigade, hailed the heroic operation against Israeli forces in the West Bank. Abu Ubaidah described the operation as a response to the aggression that has turned the lives of Palestinians into an unbearable hell. He called on Palestinian youth to escalate resistance throughout the West Bank and Al-Quds to stop Israel's plan for annexing the entire territory. Our West Bank correspondent Akama joined us earlier with the latest update on Israeli crimes across the occupied Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
And since the hours of the morning, the IOF has raided most of the Palestinian cities, starting off Jenin, where they have killed one Palestinian man, where the IOF claimed that he was trying, Ahmed Nermour, 55 years old Palestinian. The IOF claimed that he was trying to perform a stabbing operation, and so they shot him, and then the military vehicle ran over his body and detained his body in the village of Romane in Jenin. Also in Jenin, if we are to stay in Jenin, many areas in Jenin were raided today, like Kabatia, Ya'bet, Kufrdan, and Al-Yamun. Of course, Jenin was not the only theater of events in the West Bank. Many areas in Fulkerim have been witnessing, and until now, as I'm speaking to you, a violent raid towards the Palestinian homes in Fulkerim, where reportedly, and according to local resources, five Palestinians freed prisoners from the last patch from the hostage deal that took place earlier this year have been rearrested from inside Fulkerim. Of course, the Israeli settlers were not looking and standing by. The aggression of the Israeli settlers continue in the West Bank, where the Israeli settlers have raided a north of Escalier.
A prominent pro-Palestine Columbia University graduate has sued U.S. President Donald Trump's administration for $20 million over his arrest and detention by immigration agents. Mahmoud Khalil, one of the leaders of the pro-Palestinian protests in American campuses, was in custody following his arrest in March. He was freed from a federal immigration detention center in Louisiana last month, hours after a judge ordered his release on bail. The legal group backing Khalil said in a statement that the Trump administration carried out its illegal plan to arrest, detain, and deport Khalil in a manner calculated to terrorize him and his family. It added that during his detention, Khalil suffered severe emotional distress, economic hardship, and damage to his reputation. Khalil called the lawsuit a step further towards accountability, stressing that there must be accountability for political retaliation and abuse of power. And that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you so much for staying with us. Goodbye for now.
Not about killing.
Israeli regime announced the largest land confiscation in the West Bank. 52,000 dunums were announced state lands over here, which leaves more than 61% of Area C in the hands of the Israeli occupation. The dream of a viable Palestinian state, a sovereign state, is remained in the wind. What does these new developments signal for the Palestinian state and for the Palestinian geography? These topics will be discussed today with my guests over here. Mr. Jamal Jim'a, the coordinator of the Palestinian Grassroots Anti-Apartheid Campaign, welcome. And Mr. Mohammed Al-Qiq, the Palestinian journalist and analyst. Thank you for joining us today. Well, let me, Mr. Jamal, let me start with this idea. How does these land confiscation, the surge in this land confiscation that we have been seeing on the ground, how does it signal for a future of the Palestinian state and for the West Bank itself? We are seeing more land confiscation, more settlement expansion, more land encroaching, of course. This leaves the West Bank. Where does it exactly leave the West Bank?
The Israeli regime is running ahead of time for the annexation, to implement the annexation plan on the ground. So it's not about what the government itself has been confiscated officially by military courts like decisions or military orders, but the one that's more dangerous than that is what the settlers, this fascist militia of the settlers, that they are now in the spearhead of the attacking with the Palestinians, what they do. Since the beginning of 2023 until now, we are talking about the expulsion of 65 Palestinian communities in Area C. You know what does it mean for the confiscation of land? Around 900 square kilometers of land that has been confiscated and taken over robbery. It's not with any decisions. And they replaced the Palestinian communities with the outpost and the settlement. So we are talking about 15% of the West Bank that has been confiscated this way. So we shouldn't just look at what officially they have been announced, but also what they are doing in general in the West Bank. Now we are facing a massive ethnic cleansing of Area C. It's even go beyond Area C. Last year they confiscated 34,000 dunums in Area B, and they started destroying the Palestinian house in Area B. And they were even ordering or asking the Palestinian councils that supposedly were ruling these villages to take permission from the civil administration for the buildings.
Permissions, of course, that the Israeli government does not even grant for Palestinians.
Of course, if you talk about permissions has been used to prevent Palestinians from building. And this is particularly in Jerusalem, it's much more worse. But as well, in the Area B, all the villages, like, take their permissions and license from the village council. But this is new interference that shows what Israel is thinking for the future of the West Bank. Clearly what Israel is going for, taking over all Area C, as much as they can, taking over land, pushing people out, and building colonies, settlements, and their infrastructure. You know, they are building the biggest infrastructure since decades in the West Bank now. All this infrastructure is meant to shape the geopolitical map of the West Bank, including the settlements, the outposts, the bypass roads, these highways. This will be marking what the Palestinian future should be, which is in Bantustans, isolations in different areas of the West Bank, cut off from each other under full Israeli control, and they are the one who's deciding on the future of the Palestinian in this case. While all Area C, when you talk about Area C, we are talking about all the Palestinian resources, water, land, animal husbandry, agriculture, and also the most important, the expansion in the future for the Palestinian villages. And if you look at the future map, trying to imagine it with what they are doing now, we will witness in the West Bank more than Gaza Strip in each part of the West Bank. Isolations without any resources. It will be like crowded of people. You can imagine after 20 years when the population is doubled, where the people is going to go. So if you look, what will happen? There is no Palestinian state will be allowed. Anyway, without doing what they are doing now, it's impossible to have a Palestinian state while the settler colonial project is going on and what it is doing in the West Bank. So what they are now reinforcing in the West Bank is this. When they talk about the tunnels that they want to open from Al-Azariya to Zayim, this is to close the whole area from Jerusalem up to Jericho and ethnically cleanse 22 Bedouin communities in that area. No Palestinians will be allowed to be there. It will be cleaned from any Palestinian. So look at the map. It means that all the Palestinians will go through this tunnel to the north. They can't go anywhere to another place. And this is the only passage. So easily they can control the Palestinian life, Palestinian movements. Whenever they want, they close it, like what they are doing today.
This is what we are seeing now, actually, in the West Bank, as we are talking about more than 1,200 checkpoints that are closing every city, every village, cutting off this like geographical extent between each other.
And also, like in this, when we talk about this 1,200 gates, roadblocks, and checkpoints, there are several purposes for these blocks. Many of them, by the way, has been blocking the Palestinian villages from their orchards, from their land that they are living from it, like the olive groves that in the mountains of the West Bank. So this year, by the way, anyway, in the last 2 years, 70% of the Palestinian orchards, they didn't able to pick it. This year, it will be much more worse to you. I didn't expect that they will be able to do that. The other important thing, by the way, that nobody talk about, when you talk about the expulsion of the Bedouin communities in the Jordan Valley and in Area C, they get rid totally of the animal husbandry in the West Bank. That's where we get the meat, the cheese, the milk, all the animal production. It's from that areas that they are now getting rid of it. Same with the agriculture. Jordan Valley, it is like one of the most fertile areas. That it's the big reserve for the Palestinian people. Without the Jordan Valley, you don't have any resources left for the plant production as well.
Seems like that there is a planned policy for maybe like starving Palestinians or create new facts on the ground to push out Palestinians to immigrate, to feel that they do not feel comfortable enough to live in this area. Mr. Mohammed, let me take this question with you. Do you see that these policies of land confiscation, as Mr. Jamal said, this is actually quite important topic, and we will be discussing these terms, and we will be discussing these details even further. Making Palestine over here, we have a rural community. We rely on agriculture. We rely on the Bedouin communities for food and so on. So do you think that these policies are designed to push the Palestinians out of the West Bank?
Absolutely, yes. First of and foremost, the Israeli entity was built on the basis of the deterrence, the intimidation, the attacks, and expansions. Now, when we see their actions on the ground, that will remind us with their actions since 1984. And when we talk about the roots, we need to remember the Balfour Declaration, when he promised the Jewish with our land, turned us from natives who lived in this land for millennia, the cradle of civilization, the birthplace, Christianity, to non-minority Jewish minorities. This is the problem with the Israeli entity now. And by the way, Netanyahu, even his policies was built on the expansion of the land. Now, with their failure in front of Iran, with their failure in Gaza, the morale of the Israeli society reduced. Because of that, the Israeli government now decided to raise the morals by expanding the settlements in the West Bank, by unleashing the settlers with their attacks, and to convince the international community with their issue in the Arab area, they are sacrificing with their morale, their dignity. Because of that, I think the Israeli government decided three tracks. The first track, by the Israeli settlers' attacks against the towns near the apartheid wall, main roads, with the against the agricultural crops and homes, cutting off electricity and water supplies.
So you see that these attacks are actually like it's a two-faced thing. It is planned by the Israeli regime. It's not like random attacks by the Israeli settlers.
No, I think they have a huge coordination between the government and the settlers. Let me tell you something. When the Israeli government denies the settlers' attacks, or when the settlers established a new outpost on the hills near Ramallah, for example, if the government has no idea about that, why the Israeli army protect them? This is a sign that the coordination between the Israeli government and the settlers go through to implement the plan. This is the first track by the Israeli settlers. The second track by the Israeli army with its military operations against the refugee camps, as you see in in the northern of occupied West Bank, and military operations against the main cities to cram the Palestinian people inside the big cities and to pave the way for the settlers and their actions on the ground. The third track is the, an important point by the Israeli government policies to confiscate the Area C according to the Oslo Accords and to prevent Palestinian people from building, from moving, erecting military barriers, military towers, even iron gates in entrances of the cities to cut the geographic connectivity to prevent any movement to let the settlers take their time to implement their plan. This is the critical point now in front of the international community and inside the Palestinian society about the big question, where is our stability? Where is our safety? This is a dangerous point now.
Okay, so let me just take this point. You have too mentioned that the settlement expansion and the land confiscation is not segregated from the settlers' attack. Just last year, we have witnessed almost, according, of course, to Palestinian officials, 16,600 settler attacks. Throughout this year, since the beginning of January and until now, we are talking about almost 7,000 settler attacks. There is a surge in the settlers' attacks. Of course, we are not debating that this has started only 2 years ago, which is since the beginning of the genocide upon the Palestinian people, especially in Gaza and in the West Bank. This has been going on for years, but we have been seeing an escalation in the settlers' attacks. How can we connect the Mr. Jamal, if I may ask, how can we connect the approval of 22 new settlements across the West Bank with this surge of settler violence? So the Israeli government approves new settlements. The Israeli settlers are, if we are to call it this way, takes the green light, are unleashed to attack more Palestinians, to cause more casualties, just like we have seen last week in Kfar Malik, for example, in Masafer Yatta, in Susia village, many areas, especially in the area of southern Nablus villages. We are seeing that these settlements are reflecting itself on the daily lives of the Palestinians. How can we connect between these two ideas? Settlement expansion, does it lead to more settler violence?
Now, first of all, when you talk about the settler colonial project, this is the essence of the Israeli regime and the Zionist plan in the West Bank. From the early beginning, from the first day of the occupation of 67, they start building settlements. Second year, they had like Alon plan, which they built. They construct the Alon street to isolate all Jordan Valley, which is started from there. the whole project of settlements all along the West Bank. There was no single settlement or outpost or pastoral outpost has been built randomly. It has been planned very well. Big settlements has been planted on the roots of the West Bank, on the main junctions of the West Bank that allow for them the control on the West Bank, the destruction of the continuity of the West Bank. Then it comes the outpost. The outpost came, they built it to connect the big colonies together and to take as much land as they can. Then it came the pastoral settlement. The pastoral settlement has one major goal, the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, to be the spearhead of the attack on the Palestinians. And this is, before you comment, this is by the way, remind us exactly for what was happening in 1948. This militias, that trained, militarized by the government, backed by the military, with all the means that they need, including the laws, including giving them the responsibility even of arresting the Palestinian people, of confiscating their cars and their machines and their lands. Now they are going with the military uniform when they attack the Palestinian communities. So this pastoral colonies, all these young fascist guys that they are in this, they are paid salaries. It has been working under direct instruction of the Yesha Council, which is the settlements council, which is now, Yesha Council is the one who's ruling Israel. Smotrich, Ben Gvir, all those that you see in the government and the Knesset, they are coming from the school. They are coming, many of them is living in the settlement, and they've grown up there. So it is all coming together. Now, the one who's leading the whole implementing of the ethnic cleansing plan that will lead to the annexation of the West Bank that they are talking about, which is going on, are the settlers. When we talk about settlers, we are talking about an organized militias that has been working under one supervision. And that's what we saw on the ground. When they want to attack a place, suddenly by telephone call, you will find thousands of them is gathering immediately like this. When they attack the Palestinian communities, you see that they are very well trained. They have one uniform. Sometimes they are wearing whites, veiling themselves. So they are doing this in a very like sophisticated way. It's not randomly that they are attacking people with stones.
Under the of the Israeli army.
So this is, you know, so there's no disconnection from this. This is a plan that has been organized from the head of the Israeli regime, and the implementation has been done mainly in the forefront of the settlers, with the back of the military and the plan, and also the financing. It's by the Israeli government itself.
Yes, and my comment was on what you have mentioned. It's actually quite very alarming that we have been seeing this on the ground. Maybe some people would say, okay, this is a settler with two or three sheep grazing or herding his sheep and so on. What can be some damage or harm to come out of a man who just grazes his sheep? But we have seen this actually on the ground. We have went to, for example, Arab Limlihat are now being kicked out of their land that they have inhabited for more than 80 years. We have been talking to them, and they have been saying that we have been here for tens of years. And it all started with one settler taking two or three sheep. So this is my next question to you, Mr. Muhammad, is that this is like an old new world, which is the settlement, the grazing settlement. Or how does this policy is actually in line? How can we see that the Israeli settlers, or the boys of the hills, as they call themselves? Just like you have mentioned, Mr. Jamal, exactly, organized, well-trained, they attack Palestinians and they hurt Palestinians. So this leaves the Palestinians in front of what? This leaves the Palestinians bare-chested in front of an organized militia, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. A group of settlers who call themselves Youth of the Hills began practicing pastoral settlement in the Palestinian areas. The settlers bring their livestock, prevent the Palestinians from grazing, gradually seize their land. The frequency of Israeli attacks on the Bedouin communities and the Israeli and the Palestinian villages has doubled. The Israeli soldiers and the settlers work together to expel the Palestinian people through non-stop assault, beating or killing residents, stealing livestock, attacking Palestinian cars, blocking roads and shooting passerby. All these acts to force people to leave. Because of that, the policy of ethnic cleansing is practiced by demolishing homes, confiscating properties, forcibly displacing the Palestinian people using racist and illegal means. All these acts are carried out in violation of all international law, treaties, agreements, most notably the four Geneva Convention of 1940.
War crimes.
Of 1949, and the Hague Convention relating of peaceful settlement of international disputes, and the Convention on the Rights of a Child of 1989. There is no clause in the Charter of the United Nations that hasn't been blatantly violated by Israel, by Israeli army, and by the settlers to vanish the Palestinian sovereignty, to obliterate the refugee status, which is one of the fundamental pillars on the, of the Palestinian state and enable internationally recognized the right of return. These actions, coinciding with the policies on the ground and inside the government's offices, I think this is not a coincidence. I think there is a plan to implement the annexation plan, by the way, the century of
Well, actually, if we are to talk about annexation, it's not a plan anymore. I think we agree on this.
Yeah.
So we are seeing annexation every day. You have mentioned very important point that I would like to highlight and to end this discussion with, which is the international community. The international community, as you have said, it is condemned. The Israeli settlement is illegal under the international law. Every state knows that the settlers are acting illegally, and they have crossed a lot of red lines. So where does this leave the Palestinian? Maybe this is the, let's call it the hard, easy question. When this is all done under the nose and under the eyes of the international community, where does this actually leave the Palestinians? Let me take the answer from you, Mr. Jamath.
The Palestinians has been left alone with this, and this is not from now. And maybe we discover it and became so vivid after 7th of October, how we saw very clearly that this is what so-called the progressive democratic societies that they are singing of the human rights all the time.
Double standards.
It's became like for Palestinians, this is not that apply to them, and which is they saw the genocide that's going on 24 hours, taped live. And in spite of this, they are supporting Israel with military and standing with Israel totally. So here it just like shows us that when you talk about the human rights, when you talk about the international law and the human rights is in the hands and the clues of this colonial powers. And it doesn't serve people in the South. It doesn't serve us as the Palestinians or the Africans
so
or the Latin Americans or whoever.
Yeah, this leaves us where?
Yeah, and the Americans, a British, whatever, like any Israelis, they are immune. They are above the international law. So this has been put a big question mark on these charters of human rights that people and all around the world has to review back again. Human rights should be for everybody. But this is racist, colonial countries that they are using these charters of human rights just like to oppress the other people and to implement it on other people. When they invaded Iraq and destroyed Iraq three decades ago, they went under the umbrella of the international law. And when we saw in the international law, the same with Ukraine against the Russian. But when all the massacres that we faced as a Palestinians, the Iraqis, the millions that have been people being killed in Afghanistan and everywhere, There's no international law. So it's the time for us as a people, all around the world, like movements, parties, whoever, like parliamentarians, trade unions, all the what's so-called the civil society in the world, if it is, we can say that. Like, they has to stand up again and to question all these policies. It's left us alone, not from now, from 48, from hundreds of international law in the United Nations and the United Nations resolutions that have been banned still there, like, and handed in their lists. So at the end, if you are not strong, if you don't depend on your own capacity as a people and trust yourself and have confidence in yourself, nobody will look at you. And that's raised in front of us a big question as a Palestinians. Do we want to still waiting for the British and the Americans and the Europeans to finally come and to say, no, you are good people, you are massacred, so we have to do something? No, they are not going to do that. If we even have been massacred in the West Bank, they will not do anything. Became so clear. Israel is a cornerstone for colonialism in the Middle East. Israel must be and continue to be a superpower. And that shows, all the last 2 years shows that clearly. It's about us as a people, Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, everywhere, all free people around the world, to rethink again for our future as a people. Because this doesn't just like affect the Palestinian people,
yes.
It affects
yes,
the whole world.
Of course.
The whole people around the world.
Of course. Well, Mr. Mohammed, in 10 seconds, just let me take one last message for you, from you. Israel won't adhere to the international law. As Mr. Jamal said, it's quite enlightening, actually, what you have said. It is up to the Palestinians to do what? In 10 seconds, please.
Unfortunately, Israel used the Oslo Accords to pass its plan. And this requires investing in the to both positions by the Palestinians through putting their internal home in order, and unifying their decision to be a strong platform for the League of Arab States and the organization Islamic Conference in the international arena, and to stop normalization as well as at least the Arab Peace Initiative adopted in Beirut summit in 2002 was not implemented. The Palestinian issue must be brought back to the international arena, not by the American envoy with Israeli standards, from the illusion peace in Oslo Accords to the weak mediator who doesn't deter the, or at least prevent the violator of the agreement in this case. Because of that, we need to unify our decision and to review at least our priorities,
yes,
inside our
yes,
political issue and our relations with the international community after the absence of the,
yes,
international real will, the silence of the Arab states. We are in a big dilemma, unfortunately.
Yes, seems, of course, as you have mentioned, it seems like a national program is pretty much needed. It's what is needed the most in this era of the Palestinian lives. I thank you so much for joining me today in this very enlightening conversation. Mr. Jamal Jamaa, the coordinator for the Palestinian Grassroots Anti-Apartheid Campaign, thank you so much. Mr. Mohammed Al-Qiq, the Palestinian journalist and analyst, thank you for joining us. And thank you, our viewers, for joining us in this interview. And until we meet again, bye-bye.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
May peace, blessings, and mercy from God be with you. A young man from Qom, Iran, excelled in his undergraduate studies in electrical engineering, earning a scholarship for his graduate studies at American universities. He graduated with honors with a master's degree in the same field from the University of Texas, and later pursued further education to achieve a doctorate in nuclear energy engineering at the University of Berkeley, California. Due to his outstanding performance, he was offered a teaching position at this prestigious university in such a significant field. However, despite all these accomplishments, at the end of the 1960s, this young man chose to leave everything behind in the United States and go to Lebanon. He settled in the South among tens of thousands of underprivileged, displaced, and refugee individuals who faced daily airstrikes, artillery bombardments, incursions, and massacres. This PhD in nuclear engineering, a graduate of Berkeley, shared food with impoverished youth who were in their own land, yet under the fire of the most powerful force in the region. The name of this man would soon become crucial in the establishment of the dispossessed movement in Lebanon, and later in the training and equipping of the Lebanese resistance brigades, Amal. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, he returned to his home country, Iran, and was appointed Minister of Defense during a time of widespread war that the nation was engaged in. During his time as Minister of Defense, he didn't just stay in offices or chambers. He was present at the front lines, among fighters and civilians, until his martyrdom in 1981. This is not just the story of the martyr Mustafa Chamran, a leader known both to the resistance in Lebanon and to his people in Iran. It's also the narrative of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and a summary of the phrase we've heard most frequently for at least the last 22 years, the Iranian Project. In this episode of Black Box, we'll shed light on the reality of the Iranian project and why the United States and Israel are fighting it so aggressively. Mustafa Chamran was not just an exceptional figure in the political movement we now refer to as the Islamic Revolution. Like many of the symbols of this revolution, he embodied the true essence of a political movement that both Western and non-Western analysts classify as one of the most significant turning points in history. The Islamic Revolution in Iran is sometimes compared to the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and the French Revolution, as they are regarded as monumental events that changed the course of history. In this analysis, we will not reiterate the well-known facts regarding the development and events of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, nor will we examine its causes and success factors. Instead, we will focus on analyzing the characteristics that define it. It's a recognized principle that every political and social movement globally, including revolutions, has political objectives and a specific vision for society and the state. These elements form the defining characteristic that distinguishes such a movement or revolution. Throughout human political history, revolutions have always and inevitably possessed a defining characteristic that stands in opposition to the existing reality against which they were originally established. For instance, the defining feature of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia was the collapse of the Russian Empire and the realization of socialist and communist thought, transitioning from theory to practice, and this did not happen solely within the borders of Russia. The Cuban Revolution, for example, was characterized by the quest for independence of Latin American societies against U.S. hegemony and its governing tools, in addition to embracing socialism as a counter to capitalist exploitation. In contrast, the so-called Orange Revolution in Ukraine, through its various phases, was marked by a faction of Ukrainians yearning to join NATO and Europe, aiming to free Ukraine from Russian influence. In summary, no revolution exists without a project and an identity that challenged the reality against which it revolted. If a political movement aligns with the political identity and the overall vision of the state's position in its environment and the world, then it is merely an attempt at reform or a superficial change in governance mechanisms, and it certainly cannot be deemed a revolution. When we apply this criterion to the events in Iran, we find that the defining feature of the Iranian revolution was not merely the overthrow of the Shah and the establishment of the Islamic Republic. Instead, the true defining essence of the Islamic revolution in Iran was a radical shift in Iran's foreign policy and its position within the regional conflict. It is well known that the Shah's regime was Israel's greatest ally in the region, to the extent that the Iranian military and intelligence services acted as Israel's police in the Arab world. During this time, even though the Shah was Shia, and despite the fact that the three islands of Greater Tomb, Lesser Tomb, and Abu Musa, which are near the maritime borders of the United Arab Emirates, were under Iranian control since the Shah's era, and despite the Iranian army's involvement in attacks against Arab communities, such as the campaign to suppress the Dhofar revolution in Oman, in addition to its role in security and intelligence supporting Israel against Arab resistance movements, despite all of this, the Arab regimes that today wave the banner of defending Arabism against Iran were completely subordinate to the Iranian Shah. These regimes, many of which are currently involved in sectarian mobilization against Iran, seem content and reconciled with the Shia identity of the Shah of Iran. Certainly, the reactionary Arab regimes did not change. What did change was the government in Iran. With the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran in February 1979 and the unexpected rise to power of Imam Khomeini, the new Iranian leaders quickly embraced the revolution's identity. This was evident in two key events that shaped the history of the revolution and the region. The first was the closure of the Israeli embassy in Tehran, its transformation into a Palestinian embassy, and its handover to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO. The second was the takeover of the American embassy in Tehran, where dozens of employees and agents were taken hostage for over a year. The attack on both embassies, with its deep political symbol, it's important to note that we do not intend to praise or glorify these events, but rather to remember and reinterpret historical occurrences. At that time, the slogans to combat imperialism and reject the Shah's submission to the West had already been raised from the very start of the revolution. However, their implementation on the ground, right at the moment of the Shah's fall, that is, with the victory of the revolution and the disruption of the balance of power, was the true test of these slogans. The Iranian revolutionaries managed to astonish both friends and foes. It's important to remember that declaring hostility toward the United States is never easy for any revolution in the world, especially if the pre-revolutionary status quo was one of total submission to the West and near absolute U.S. control over the state and its institutions. For this reason, Iran's decision to prioritize the Palestinian cause for the revolution and the post-revolutionary society posed a significant challenge to the revolution itself. When we examine the history of that period, this challenge becomes even more pronounced, considering that the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran coincided with the signing of the Camp David Accords between Egypt and Israel. These accords not only removed Egypt from the conflict and turned it into a sphere of American influence, but they also effectively dismantled any project of Arab resistance. As the Israeli embassy opened its doors in Cairo, right at the center of the Arab initiative, at that very moment, the Israeli embassy in Tehran was shutting down, and the Palestinian flag was raised in its stead. The chance of hostility towards the United States and Zionism not only redirected the path of the Iranian people, but also provided a lifeline to all Arabs who opposed Western hegemony and the Zionist project. It's no coincidence that the first world leader to arrive in Tehran after the victory of the Islamic Revolution and be welcomed as a conquering hero was Yasser Arafat, leader of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Arafat believed that the Iranian revolution would rescue Palestine from Israeli aggression. The challenge to the United States and the resolve to fill the void left by Egypt's exit from the conflict, even if only partially, shaped the Iranian project, an Islamic revolutionary initiative that opposes Western hegemony and aims to eliminate the Zionist entity. The leaders of the Iranian revolution were aware of the nature of the conflict with global hegemony, as reflected in the famous words of Imam Khomeini, "The United States is the great Satan." We can assert that this slogan defined the main contradiction of the Iranian revolution, its opposition to the global hegemonic powers, specifically the United States. The Iranian revolutionary understanding concluded that achieving the interests of the Iranian people, including security, protection, and independence, can only be realized by breaking the hegemonic project in the region and worldwide. This connection between domestic and foreign policy is the primary driving force behind all Iranian activity, both within and outside of Iran. It's the fundamental driving force of the Iranian project. For this reason, the Islamic Republic of Iran has allocated a significant portion of its state budget to support the resistance in Palestine and Lebanon. This means that Iran has diverted part of its internal power to support external movements. Let's also remember that the former commander of the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, IRGC, General Qasem Soleimani, played a crucial role in liberating Iraq from Daesh. In the initial phase, he was vital in preventing the entire country from falling into the hands of Daesh, including Baghdad, southern Iraq, and the Kurdistan region. This is something that both Arab and Kurdish Iraqi authorities acknowledge. Later on, he played a significant role in supporting the Iraqis to free their country from Daesh. During this time, Soleimani operated outside of Iran's borders, and his efforts had a direct and substantial impact on the stability within Iran. In short, if Daesh had taken control of all of Iraq, it would undoubtedly have spread to neighboring countries, including and perhaps most notably Iran. This ability to blend internal and external influence in Iranian politics was not confined to the borders of our region and its crises. Rather, it evolved over time, turning Iran into a driving force behind the formation of a global alliance of liberation movements. Since the success of the Islamic Revolution, the leaders of the Islamic Republic of Iran have highlighted the connection between the revolution and global liberation movements. As a result, we find the name of the Irish fighter and martyr, Bobby Sands, on one of the main streets in Tehran, and in front of him, a commemorative plaque for the martyr Qasem Soleimani in Caracas, the capital of Venezuela in Latin America. The international dimension of the Islamic Revolution is a crucial part of the Iranian project. This project has reached the same conclusion as the revolutionaries of Vietnam and China. There is a connection in the confrontations against U.S. hegemony. In other words, every defeat of the United States signifies a victory for all oppressed peoples, and every defeat of a people oppressed by the United States represents a loss for everyone else. This international perspective on Iran's role was summarized by the leaders of the revolution themselves, who established the principle of supporting the oppressed. This principle, in addition to its moral and ideological dimensions, has a direct impact on achieving the common interests of all peoples affected by American hegemony. For this reason, we often hear accusations in the media against Iran for exporting the revolution. These accusations mostly come from the Arab regimes, which seek normalization of ties with Israel. These accusations reveal the superficiality of their supporters and their focus on terrorizing and frightening people with a baseless Iranian ghost. Why do we talk about superficiality? Because